And so now we will pick up the topic of money and politics, kind of where we left it off. I think there were some, you know, really interesting ideas that are already on the table from the last session that I'd like to pick up with this session, particularly talking about we always talk about the role of money in politics is an issue even when the government is functioning reasonably well. In terms of corruption and things like that. In this panel, I think we'd like to narrow the scope of a conversation about money in politics a little bit to its particular role in the current kind of dysfunction. So particularly looking at issues of the role of independent spending in affecting legislative behavior, effects of past reforms, but in particular other solutions that are out there, things that might be untested or actually beginning to work, and what we think or know are their role in affecting either the behavior of voters, the behavior of legislators, the basic ability of the system to function. So slightly narrower dimension of the question of money and politics. We're going to have a relatively small panel so that I'm looking at a lot of people in this room who have a lot to contribute on this issue. So we will try to get everyone in. We'll have a relatively small panel. We are Spencer Overton of George Washington University Law School was intended to be on this panel. As some of you may know, he's just been appointed the interim president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, the Washington think tank that historically is focused on African-American issues, which is, you know, both terrific for him and for that organization, which should be which deserves to be a healthy and vibrant organization. So while Spencer will be here later, and I think part of the day tomorrow, he can't be on this panel because of the obligations of this new job, which is too bad. But we will make up for it with the following panel. First, we'll hear from Heather McGee, who is recently appointed the president of Demos and has been vice president of Demos and a colleague of mine in a couple of different roles and really a very central thinker on some of these issues of money and politics. Followed by Shara Torres-Felicy, who is an assistant professor at Stetson University Law School, a fellow at the Brennan Center, and was full-time at the Brennan Center for some period of time, and has really opened up some important new angles of thinking about especially the role of corporate money in politics. And finally, Michael Malbin, who is the co-founder and the executive director of the Campaign Finance Institute, as well as a professor at SUNY Albany, and you're really the leading research voice on really how some of the solution approaches work. So with that, I'm turning it over to Heather.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Thank you to the Hewlett Foundation and to our brothers and sisters at the Brennan Center for hosting this great convening. So I am going to talk about the issue of money in politics and how it relates to democratic dysfunction and try to zoom us back a little bit from a definition of dysfunction that might have us focus very much on sort of the post-2010 moment, although there's ways that these trends have been exacerbated because of economic shifts as well as the political shifts and the congressional process shifts. To sort of interrogate the idea of polarization as just being as between the two parties in the political class, and that being one of the form of polarization that we should be most concerned with, although I think it is concerning. But I also want us to think as well about the polarization as between the political class and the rest of America. And the political class I'm defining for these purposes as elected officials as well as the donors who increasingly have become their constituents. And it is therefore, I think, good to bring Justice Brandeis into the room and his definition of a dysfunction of democracy, and think about how that relates to what is also the signal feature of this moment, which is economic inequality. The lack of representation in a republic should give us great alarm. And when I say that, I want to remind myself always, I think we often in the reform movement and the policy world speak as if there were a greater moment of high functioning than today. It's sort of reflexive. Things have gotten worse. But when you think about a really participatory democracy and a really representative republic, we've never had it. And that's when the lights go out. we've never had it. So I want us to try to bring into the room a bit of a lodestar that's actually more than, you know, before the 1970s or 80s, and really a lodestar for the future. Maybe I can do that with ease, given my age. But we really, the kind of democracy that is truly high-functioning is one with an entirely different set of participants, those who are unregistered, those who would never think of contributing to a candidate. And let's think about that as where we want to be fundamentally and how we can realign the incentives to get there. At Demos, we are most focused on the link between our dysfunction in our democracy and the core issue facing our economy, which is the lack of upward mobility, the increasing economic insecurity, and widening inequality. And so we've done a fair amount of original research, as well as in the great spirit of a public-facing think tank, borrowed and cajoled some amazing political scientists into letting us package and make plainer their work. And a report that I want to recommend to you called Stack Deck, the dominance of the political class, of the affluent and business, the effect of the dominance of the affluent and business on economic mobility in America. So these political science researchers, among them Marty Gillins and Larry Bartels, have basically surmised that where the political class and the donor class differs more from the rest of the country than they even do from each other is on core economic issues. The role of regulation, taxes versus spending and deficits, the minimum wage, the role of labor unions, etc. Marty Gillins has found that the American government does respond to the public's preferences, but that responsiveness is strongly tilted towards the most affluent citizens. Indeed, under most circumstances, and this will get you out of bed in the morning, the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact on which policies the government does or doesn't adopt. I'm going to zoom in just really quickly on two examples that are relevant today. One is the minimum wage, where 78% of the public believes that no, the minimum wage should be high enough so that no full-time worker is in poverty, where that is a majority opinion among even Republican voters. And I want to make a distinction that I think we should continue to make between the difference between Republicans and Democrats in the political class as opposed to Republicans and Democrats in the voting class, which is not always a distinction, but it often is. But it is a minority opinion among those survey respondents in a really groundbreaking study by Benjamin Page, which looked at people who make over $1 million a year. The capital gains issue, the issue of how we tax wealth versus work in this country, something that also, the idea that that should be equal, is something that also gets majority support among Republican voters. But we all know where we are, where we've seen continuous decreases in the capital gains rate, except, of course, during the fiscal cliff deal when it was increased just a bit. So if you redefine the idea or add to the idea of the problem we should solve, one of a fundamental dysfunction that is predicated on a lack of representativeness by income, and that economic interest being one where you see real cleavages, not between Democrats and Republicans who are actively involved in politics, but between the people who are actively involved in politics and those who are not or are just by the dint of their once every couple of years vote. It calls for different solutions, I think, than some of the ones that we've discussed today. I'm sure we'll talk a bit about that, and there are some people in the room who can really get into this issue of public financing, but I want to end on a note of hope about the possibility of bringing in more voices and into the donor class and shifting the attention of our elected officials to people who can't write $10,000 checks. In Connecticut, where Miles Rappaport, the outgoing president of Demos, was a legislator and the secretary of state, we did a study that looked at interviews from legislators and activists about the effect of public financing that was passed there some years back in 2008. And here's what is encouraging. One, that it is something that Republican members and elected officials embrace and run on. Three out of every four candidates for statewide office, for the state legislature, are running on their public financing system, that this can be a bipartisan embrace, even among legislators. I have a quote here from Representative Adinolfi, who's a Republican. He says, "People concentrate more on the issues. You see more votes that are bipartisan, and the big issues get bipartisan votes." I think that's encouraging as we think of the polarization of our elected officials on these issues of reform. And the fact is that we have one Republican on a new bill in Congress, in the House, the Government by the People Act, which would create a small donor match public financing for Congress. And there are people in this room, my friends of Public Campaign, who can talk a fair amount more of that in detail. But I think that we should really be looking at defining the problem, particularly in this moment of existential crisis in the functioning of our economy, which is set by the rules that are decided in Washington and in the state houses, as one that really reorients the elected officials at the state houses and in Washington to the needs of people who cannot be a part of the donor class under our current system.
Thank you, Heather. Chara.
Good afternoon. My name is Chara Torres-Felici, and I'm going to try to do in 5 minutes what I did in 20 just last week at Duke Law School. So in a nutshell, I work on the issue of what the proper role of corporate money is in a democracy. If Heather Gerken is trying to harness politics to fix politics, I am trying to harness greed to fix politics. And I love Neera Tanden's concept of, am I playing with a grenade? And perhaps I am. So one of the things that I'm trying to do with this work is to move beyond red and blue and to get people to focus on green. So one of the reasons I do this is that I've long suspected that having corporate money in our political system is a lose-lose proposition. I think it's bad for democracy, and I think on the whole it's bad for business, and that it creates incentives that run entirely the wrong way. I think we are a long way from the old quote, if it's good for GM, it's good for America, if that was even true in the 1950s. So I spend a lot of time on the issue of pay-to-play, specifically the Securities and Exchange Commission's anti-pay-to-play rules and laws. The big three that I am focused on are the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is a federal statute, and then the SEC has two anti-pay-to-play rules, one for municipal bond dealers, and one for the investment advisors of public pension funds. And all of these rules work to protect both democratically elected officials as well as the integrity of the capital markets. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating when you contrast what the Securities and Exchange Commission does with its enforcement power compared to what the Federal Election Commission does with its enforcement power is even when the FEC, the Federal Elections Regulators, issue big fines, their biggest fine, which was against Freddie Mac, was for $3.8 million, which I think from Freddie Mac's point of view is a cost of doing business amount. By contrast, in enforcing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the SEC often levies fines that are hundreds of millions of dollars. For example, they fined Siemens $450 million for violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and that is at a level which might actually change behavior. So one of the things that I work on is trying to get the Securities and Exchange Commission to promulgate a new rule that would require disclosure of corporate political spending by publicly traded companies. This is a good news, bad news situation right now. The good news is that 700,000 members of the public took time out of their day and have written public comments to the agency requesting that they act. The bad news is the rulemaking, which was on the regulatory agenda for 2013, has been taken off the agenda for 2014. So I work with a group called the Corporate Reform Coalition, and we are continuing to put pressure on the commission to put that rulemaking back on the regulatory agenda. And it is no doubt a heavy lift, but I think, ironically, one of the ways to get past this red versus blue is really to focus on green. I think if you can get shareholders, especially institutional shareholders, to think of political spending as a waste of corporate resources, then that may be one tool in the toolbox to mitigate the potential damage of Citizens United, Speech Now, and Bellotti. For the funders in the room, I would encourage you not to put all of your eggs in the litigation basket. We need corporate lawyers, too. From the research perspective, if you are setting a research agenda, pay-to-play hurts honest businessmen, and it also costs taxpayers more money. They end up paying more for bringing municipal bonds to market, and they end up paying more to fund their public pensions. So one of the things that I think needs research desperately is what is the true cost of corruption and who's paying that cost? Is it being paid by shareholders? Is it being paid by taxpayers? Because those are huge constituencies which are bipartisan. And furthermore, we need research on a cost-benefit analysis that could survive scrutiny in the DC circuit. One of the ways that a lot of the Dodd-Frank rules are going down is because the court there is deeming that the agencies promulgating the rules under Dodd-Frank have not done a sufficient cost-benefit analysis. But this gets incredibly tricky when the cost is a real dollar figure cost and the benefit is a democracy that has integrity. So I'll also leave on a hopeful note. I am, of course, disappointed that the SEC took this rulemaking off of their regulatory agenda, but I'm also heartened by the fact that their last pay-to-play rule took 9 years to implement, or to get the rulemaking going. But they eventually got there, and I think they'll eventually get there with this as well.
Thank you very much, Chair. Michael Malvin.
Thank you. Thanks for having this conference. Michael Waldman's introduction to the written program said there are no magic bullets, and the solutions of the 1970s are not likely to be tomorrow's solutions. I agree, but I want to go further. The methods we used to figure out potential solutions also have to change. If you reread the old speeches on money and politics, you'll see that the sponsors of reforms often made very large claims. They would say, for example, and I'm talking mostly about elected officials who make these claims, they would say, for example, that their proposals would cut way down on corruption, transform the power of special interests, and restore the public's confidence in government. And over the years, those kind of large claims became targets for quantitatively sophisticated but ultimately shallow opposition research. I'm thinking, for example, of articles showing that contribution limits were not associated with a statistically significant change in criminal indictments for corruption or an increase in public trust. Well, rhetoric aside, there's no real reason why any social scientist would ever have predicted those kinds of changes. Those of us who support contribution limits, and I do not expect them to deter behavior that was already criminal. Nor does anyone seriously expect the change in campaign finance law by itself to be the determinant of public trust. I don't to blame the critics for refuting what was almost a straw man. Overblown claims invite potshots, and unfortunately, the problem of overclaiming is not merely historical. Today, we sometimes hear it said that the goal was not merely to countervail, but to put an end to the power of big money. We hear this mostly in the political arena. We hear it said that if only for the not for the Supreme Court, the solution would be to regulate spending. And my view is that even though some new regulations could make a positive difference, it doesn't get at a number of core issues. And here I'm going back to, I'll be speaking of some of the points Heather McGee included in her definition of dysfunction. Now, for the core issues, you should turn to participation theory more broadly. Many of you are familiar with the work by Brady Verb and Schlossman. Their classic work draws attention to what they call the three M's: means, motivation, and mobilization. People are more likely to participate if they have the means, that is money, knowledge, or time, and if they are motivated, and if they are mobilized or asked. Publicly traded business corporations have the money to hire staff or belong to a trade association. They also have economic motivation. Those motivations generally lead them to pursue access politics rather than ideological goals. The story is different for many wealthy individuals and personally owned corporations that have been getting into politics lately. They have the means. Everybody's trying to mobilize them. Their motivations are largely ideological. Citizens United was liberating for many, but that does not mean they will stop if the decision is reversed. The core issue is that the vast majority do not participate beyond voting at all. It's not just the money and politics issue, but I'll speak about that aspect today. Low participation does not just result from a lack of money. More than half of the country gives some kind of contribution to public things, public charities over the course of a year. It's more than half of people with incomes below $50,000 give money in charity. Too often, potential donors do not know how to give, they're not asked, and they do not believe they can make a difference. And those facts are what's behind the interest in small donor matching funds. Matching funds create an incentive for some of the best mobilizers in the country, the candidates, to shift their attention. And as I stated earlier, I do support looking at matching funds for political parties, small donations. Some of you know that the Campaign Finance Institute has been doing state and federal small donor research for more than 10 years, along with research on non-party groups and independent spending. And I'm going to have to miss some of tomorrow's meeting, if you have it, to present our latest findings to the New York City Campaign Finance Board, if they meet. Our past findings show that small donor matching funds in the city do make a big difference in both the number and diversity of those who give small contributions. And to answer a question that Mark sometimes likes to ask, it's also sometimes claimed that small donors feed political polarization. Our research to date says that small donors are no more extreme in their issue positions than large donors. They just don't lobby. And the candidates supported by small donors are pretty much the same ideologically as the Democratic and Republican co-partisans in Congress. Moving forward, what are the sponsors saying would happen if small donor fund matching funds were adopted elsewhere? And this answer shows an important makes an important change, and it's that change that I think is important moving forward, not just this one issue, small donor matching funds. And that is that I don't know anyone who's making the kinds of sweeping claims that people were putting out a generation ago. The main sponsors, sponsoring organizations, sponsoring representatives, know that voluntary matching funds will not lead directly to huge policy changes. Their goal is more modest. Their goal is to create countervailing sources, to give candidates alternative sources of funds that will get the candidates and representatives involved in connecting constituents to the political process and bringing them out. Now, that does have policy implications. If public officials have alternatives, that means big donors should be less able to hold single-issue threats over the policy agenda. And those single-issue threats are part of what helps drive paralysis on occasion. But we're not talking about direct cause and effect from new law to specific policy outcomes. In addition to the fact that today's sponsors have more modesty, I also see them as being more serious about potential side effects and unintended consequences. I've been in extended conversations with those who put together three different small donor matching fund bills over the past 2 years. Governor Cuomo's bill for New York State, the federal Price Van Hollen bill, which is essentially similar to the, follows the New York City system or is patterned after it, and the federal Sarbanes bill, which is more complicated. In all three, there's been a seriousness in the design stage that I have not seen in the past. The proposals differ, but in each case, the sponsors put their ideas out for testing and modified them in response. So this gets to my more general point beyond small donors. I am hopeful that this openness to fact-based policymaking could become more widespread, although I recognize the political forces against it. Most of us have read about the changes in electoral politics in the book, The Victory Lap. The relationships there are more direct, they're easier to specify, but even so, it is legitimate to expect future sponsors to test their proposals in advance, and then for the rest of us to test the outcomes afterwards. I say this not just about small donor proposals, but about ones related to political parties and non-party spending. The field has come a long way. I'm hopeful that it can do more.
Thank you, Michael. That's a terrific and innovative point. And I think we've also seen that systems like New York City's that are revised in response to events also are stronger than ones that remain unchanged. I'd like to maybe a little more discussion among the panelists, then open it up. One issue that I want to put on the table that kind of comes from the first session is, and it's something we'll talk about a little bit tomorrow in the political strategy session, there was a time when issues of money in politics were treated as kind of neutral rules in the system and always did have fairly strong bipartisan support. Before McCain-Feingold, there was a bill called Boren-Goldwater. It now seems like we're in a zone where the reform itself is often a very partisan, often plays out in a very partisan way. You know, it used to be the disclosure seemed to have bipartisan support, and then suddenly it didn't. So I wonder if we can just address a little bit how we can get it back to being something that's seen as at the same time that you need to mobilize constituency for it, something that can be seen as a neutral rule again, I guess.
So I'm again encouraged by looking at voters and not at members. In partnership with the Corporate Reform Coalition, Demos did an analysis of a poll in 2012 when we were starting to gear up to attention to the SEC rulemaking that had cross-ideological, libertarian, progressive, moderate, liberal, conservative responses to both propositions such as there's too much money in politics and articulations of a solution from disclosure to an amendment to the Constitution to small donor public financing, etc. And we ended up calling it Citizens Actually United, because among voters there is an incredible amount of, as you know, any sort of casual observer could see, an incredible amount of frustration with the current system and the desire for big change. So the question, I think, for the field is, can we do the basic functioning in a republic of mobilizing the Republicans who support, who would support public financing? And I think there's even much more recent data that public campaign sponsored that it's, 77% of Republicans support the Sarbanes bill? In the high 50s, oh, sorry. Still, in the high 50s for Republicans of what is seen as a sort of progressive reform idea. So, you know, it's a question of, can the voices of base voters be mobilized to put pressure on electeds who are not currently seeing it as in their short-term interest?
I think I want to, you don't have your hand up, Fred, but I want to make sure that we get you into the queue first, Fred Wertheimer, to talk about where you see the state of things on money and politics as part of government dysfunction.
And if you can turn your mic on.
There's a lot of money in politics and there's a lot of government dysfunction. At some point, I want to come back to Jonathan's point earlier on, but I don't want to do that now. This is a cyclical issue. It always has been. And we're now in a cycle where I think there is going to be new opportunities for reforms. And I think there, and we see it happening, there is an opportunity to grow a much broader reform movement than has existed for many years. The issue you raised about Republicans is central. In 40 years, at the national level, Congress has never passed a campaign finance reform bill without significant Republican leadership and significant Republican support. And from my standpoint, that is going to be continue to be the case as long as the filibuster rules exist. That means you can't impose this on Republicans. They are very suspicious that this legislation is tilted against them, campaign finance laws. They have their own political interests, such as the disclosure fight, where for almost 40 years it was a consensus approach among Democrats and Republicans that disclosure was a good thing, and post-Citizens United that immediately changed, led by Senator McConnell. In 2000, Senate Republicans voted 48-6 to close a major disclosure loophole. In 2010, they voted 39-0 against disclosure because of the politics of it. And as a general rule, the kinds of reforms we talk about, Republicans generally, I'm not talking about all of them, but conservative Republicans tend to be anti-regulation and they tend to be anti-spending. So in that context, the fact remains that we have been able to build bipartisan coalitions in the past, significant bipartisan coalitions. On McCain-Feingold, that fight beat McConnell in the Senate and Tom DeLay three times when he was a whip by getting 40-50 Republican votes, and Tom DeLay just did not lose votes. But right now, as we all see with the polarization, there's a huge job ahead to try to figure out how to get Republican support for real campaign finance bills. And it will require mass mobilization, but that won't do it by itself. It will require figuring out and work getting to a point, and this may not happen for a couple of years. This is not going to be a short process. But we have to get to a point where there are Republicans who are actually interested in doing something, and then figuring out how proposals can be matched up with their interests. In the first instance, there has to be a huge outcry from the public and a demand for this. But we should never lose sight of the fact that this is not going to be imposed on Republicans in Congress.
Great. Thank you very much, Fred. I've always been interested in what happens as Republicans as well as Democrats who've experienced the small donor systems in New York or Arizona or Connecticut begin to move up into Congress and see it as not regulation, but actually something that frees them. Larry Norton.
I was just going to talk a little bit about what's been happening in New York. There has been this drive for small donor public financing here at the state level that Michael's already mentioned. And there are a number of people in this room that have been working on it, including David Donnelly of Public Campaign and CWA. Both you, Mark, and Fred have mentioned is really true. One of the things that we're seeing in New York is the almost dogmatic resistance on the part of Republicans to public financing. So we got very close last year, but the Republicans in the state Senate were uniformly opposed, despite the fact that, you know, if you look at the polls in New York State, a majority of Republicans will say that they're in favor of a small donor matching system. And despite the fact that, you know, you have small and medium-sized businesses who are often a big Republican constituency who feel that because they can't make the kinds of contributions that bigger interests can, that they're locked out. So I do think that that's something that is going to be a continuing struggle. We're fortunate in New York that the governor has just put public financing and campaign finance reforms in his budget, so he may be able to kind of force a vote in the Senate that the Senate Republicans have not allowed in previous years. But that's obviously not going to be a solution that we can look to nationally. Well, one thing I would say that's been very interesting to me at the working on this in New York is at the state level, at least in New York, we haven't seen the kinds of independent expenditures that came after Citizens United at the federal level, at the state level, and as a result, both Republicans and Democrats at the state level are very worried about them and are much more open to looking for whatever kinds of legal solutions they can impose to try to minimize the impact of those independent expenditures. Nobody's yet invested at the state level and seeing independent expenditures work for them. So, there's been much more receptivity to looking at things like coordination rules and how to prevent coordination between candidates and big IE groups.
Great, thank you. In the back, yes.
Leslie Lowe, Rockefeller Family Fund. And as I've been listening to the discussion, and especially the conversation this morning, one of the things that seems to be missing in this equation is the revolving door, K Street. We can elect them. How do we hold them accountable? And I think the glaring example, which is glaring because of its absence, really, is the issue of the trade negotiations, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Almost no media about it. And yet this is a huge challenge to national sovereignty. Corporations can sue national governments over legislation they pass. Australia is now being sued by Philip Morris for requiring labeling on cigarette packages. So if we really think about democracy and what it means, how do we level the playing field, if it's at all possible, given the First Amendment rights to petition government, so that all the money that corporations and big donors have to invest in writing legislation, getting it passed, then gets translated into a political process where we have fast track, so that the legislators would know damn well that their constituents would oppose it if it came up for debate and a vote, can hide behind this fast track.
Thank you. That's a very important reminder that there are many ways in which economic inequality crosses over into the political process that are not simply campaign contributions. Chiara.
So one opportunity that I think was left open when the Disclose Act wasn't passed is there is a huge ambiguity in federal campaign finance law as to what a foreigner is for the purposes of corporations. It is still clear that if you are a foreign human being, you can't spend in an American election. What is really not clear is if you are a multinational corporation where most of your funding comes from abroad, you're located abroad, you're headquartered abroad, you could be owned by a foreign sovereign. Well, according to Citizens United, you get to spend in American elections. And that seems really strange to me and seems like a scandal about to happen. And that might be one of those issues where you could get people from the left and the right to come together to protect the integrity of American elections from foreign corporate money.
Larry.
Yeah, just real quick, I wanted to follow up on Leslie's comment. So the same kind of massive coalition you see in the Democracy Initiative is alive and well on this trade issue. We're trying to build it globally because of the investor-state dispute resolution. It's a democracy issue, as you just said. Philip Morris is not only suing Australia, but also Uruguay. This is supposedly violations of their intellectual property because they dare put on packages that for pregnant women there's a danger in smoking. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and we know how that's funded, is again the major player in force in pushing, putting pressure on Democrats and Republicans on fast track. So I think, again, it's not what we came here to discuss, but I think, as Leslie said, direct tie-over is between why do Americans drop out of thinking about political change and democracy when they see a Senate that right now has 184 nominations backed up, 90 judicial vacancies, a non-filibuster filibuster on virtually everything, but on this, right, because the Chamber and Business Roundtable wants it, it's not a treaty, even though Article 2 of the Constitution certainly makes it look like a treaty, but instead it's considered legislation and therefore not subject to the provisions of the Constitution on treaties and not even subject to the 60 votes that, you know, the nomination for public printer requires. So I think there is a direct link between that issue, not what we're talking about here, but the democracy that's falling apart, and that makes sense to everyday people when they see their jobs traded to a place like Vietnam with a 25-cent an hour minimum wage as part of that deal. They do give up, and for good reason.
Thank you, Larry. Michael, well.
So I have a comment and two questions for folks to think about and talk about. The comment is that one of the reasons that I'm excited about the new model of public financing that we're seeing, multiple matching funds for small contributions, is that one of the things it does is it harnesses something that is actually out there that's happening that's good. There's sort of a race over what's going to define money in politics going forward between this flood of new money coming in, not entirely, but significantly because of the court decisions, and the small donors who are coming in, not just the Obama campaign, going all the way back to the McCain and Dean and Kerry campaigns, and superpowered by the internet. And so what's exciting is that it actually takes something that's actually happening that's good and that is genuinely participatory and genuinely small-d democratic and builds it up. So that gets to my two questions. One relates to that. Are there other, we've talked about the multiple matching funds, are there other ideas that should be brought to the fore of ways to bolster participation in this way, whether through the tax code or other means that we don't know about or that should be discussed? And the second relates to both of these, which is goes back to the question of polarization and legislative dysfunction. My worry is that if the new phenomenon that we've seen especially is party members, legislators, being pulled to their own extremes by the fear of outside spending in primaries. Much as I love the independent, much as I love small donor matching funds, I worry it is not particularly designed to counter that. Or is it? In other words, we know that independent spending, because of the Supreme Court, is the hardest to get out of all the potential ills in the system. So what can we do to assure ourselves that the reforms we're talking about will not fight yesterday's battle? We saw in Wisconsin in the judicial elections there, where they had a good public financing system, where that system was swamped by Post Citizens United, Post Speech Now, independent expenditures. How can we design reforms that don't have that problem?
Rob.
Sort of wanted to piggyback on that question, which is just thinking about the issue of money in politics and polarization in particular. I think that, you know, the fact of a good public financing system in itself doesn't necessarily address that when you look at states like Arizona or Maine, which where it's working very well and interesting, but at the same time can empower people who are quite ideological and partisan on both sides and not necessarily, you know, looking to work together across party lines. One way that I've seen that it seems to operate in a way that reinforces polarization and reinforces the, you know, this rigid perception that most voters now have of the two parties is that the people who often built bridges between the parties in the past were people who were able to win in the other party's political turf, Southern Democrats, Northern Republicans, and so on. And so they had a political incentive to actually work with the other party because that was actually the majority of their constituency. And if you're in that position right now, and you could get more money as an incumbent, but if anyone could come in with an independent expenditure and remind people which side you're on, it's very hard to last in that position. Like a great example last year was that special election with Stephen Colbert's sister and Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford was a rather damaged Republican candidate, but at the end of the day, he was going to vote for John Boehner and just had to, you know, money had to remind people which side, you know, people were on, and a very Republican constituency ended up electing him. So that the money that way, you know, coming in reinforces the sort of the rigid partisanship there. And I'm just wondering if there's ideas about what could be done through a money and politics agenda that might address that.
I just want to jump in and comment on, Michael, your question about other ideas to encourage participation. There are a number of them in Spencer Overton's article, The Participation Interest. There are a number of ideas. And one he hints at that I really think ought to be on the table is thinking about raising the level of disclosure at the low end. Like, is the public interest really served by knowing every $200 contribution? Is the public interest really served by when I Google somebody that I've recently met, their political contributions come up really high? Maybe there's some common ground to be found on saying, you know, $1,000, no matter how you do it, outside, in your party, whatever, that's where the disclosure is and not otherwise. Now, it will be hard, I think, to implement that. I mean, any public matching model probably depends on a certain amount of disclosure, and there's huge amount of disclosure, but that seems to be a territory, and there's evidence that the disclosure is actually a deterrent to giving.
Michael.
That's a little. Michael.
And Wendy.
Okay. Michael and then Wendy.
We do Wendy and then me.
Okay, Wendy.
And then I was going to ask a question mainly of Michael, so maybe I will just extend your remarks on. I think there have been the ideas that have been put forward are in part are to increase participation, but also just to create countervailing forces to the influx of outside money in politics, whether it's the, you know, expanding the power of the political parties or contribution or eliminating contribution limits, whether it's small donor public financing. But I would like to hear a little bit more about what the research is on the actual influence of that outside spending on the issue of dysfunction that we're addressing today. To what extent is it actually polarizing, or is it necessarily going to continue to be polarizing? Is that just anecdotal, or and are there historic precedents for that? Is that? Then I wanted to turn to you, who've been spearheading a project looking at the state of the research. And what else do we need to know?
I love it when you ask a question when the answer is, gosh, we're just starting a project and we really need to see this through. We know that in some selected districts, independent expenditures have been targeted, have been used, and if an organization such as Club for Growth is successful in two districts, it puts the fear into very large numbers of people. We know that there is an effect. I'm going to segue to the other parts of the questions because they go to what else might you do. The Club for Growth has claimed credit for a lot. They've typically gone after incumbents who've had problems for other reasons. Most particularly, one of my favorite senators, Senator Lugar, who I admired for decades, and he's a remarkable person. But he also really had lost touch with the district, and that was a serious problem. So that becomes the pivot to Mark's question, actually to Michael's question. Does some sort of a program that stimulates or gives an incentive for candidates to deepen their ties to their own constituency, provide a counter for independent expenditures, especially parachuted in independent expenditures for people who have no ties to the constituency? And I think the answer is yes, it is an important and effective counter. Now, I would say in my personal point of view, that if a law is written in such a way that the money getting matched essentially is being raised and bundled by national organizations, then it does not have that same kind of politically empowering effect for the people who count, who can really counter the effect of the independent expenditures. What makes the difference is, can you get people to help you get voters out to the polls? And that means, so the New York City system says X amount of money needs to be raised in the district, 100 donors. I think that matters. I think that turns out to be important. Because I think that's important, I also think in some other places, you could look at tax credits or rebates or refunds like Minnesota. They are not as effective if you just look at the amount of money. But you do get candidates, we've had this in surveys, you get candidates who say that they ask different kinds of people because the money is free. They get $25, and those people become the core of their mobilization base during the last 2 months of the election. So what you need, it would not just be in money and politics, what you need are incentives that get the parties and the candidates to build themselves up, if you will, create a virtuous cycle. So they do have this comfort base that, in a sense, makes them much more invulnerable to sort of outside money.
Great. Thank you, Michael. I think Walter Shapiro had his hand up
before, and then George, and then Nick.
I just want to forgive me for leaning like this. I'm a fellow here at the Brennan Center, and probably more relevantly, I've covered the last 9 presidential campaigns. And there are just a couple of things that I just wanted to mention. Number one, there is inside the political community a class issue that it would be nice if campaign reformers could figure out a way to exploit. And that is the interest of people who run campaigns for political incumbents or political candidates versus the interest of those people who make the bulk of their money advising super PACs and other groups. The number of times in various campaigns where I've had late night drinks with campaign managers in both parties who have said, in effect, oh, this independent expenditure, God, I wish they hadn't come in. They're pushing a totally different message. We weren't ready to fight on this turf right now. And suddenly we're in the midst of all of this. So, I mean, there is an instinct on the part, not of the candidates, but of the political manager class, that they are losing control of that which they prize the most, getting people elected and reelected to politics because of the Koch brothers or because of MoveOn.org. And the other thought I just want to mention, and something that I've written about periodically, and I'm fascinated why it gets no pickup whatsoever and no interest, and that is the degree to which campaign consultants are ripping off political donors, whether they are the Koch brothers or whether they are the model $100 small giver. And the fact that since the FEC requirements are very, very vague about where the money goes. It's almost impossible for political reporters to figure out where the money goes. But as a consequence, one of the easiest ways of taking 5 to 10% off the cost of running for all political offices is have a donor rights movement demanding that campaigns reveal their contracts with their vendors. This is not proprietary information like what's the ad strategy going to be. It's just what percentage of the take does the campaign consultant get. And I really think an awful lot of donors would be appalled when they discover that in certain $50 million campaigns, the consultants are getting 11% off the top. Anyway, my hobby horse issue. Thank you.
It's a super important issue, and I think sometimes the candidates have become tougher on the consultants But the attraction of a C4 or a super PAC is, you know, there's no way to crack down
on them. There's no one to crack down.
So that's why it's more attractive to those consultants. The first point is an important reminder about the role of outside money and polarization is that we expect candidates to be accountable for their messages, and they're going to be continuing to run, whereas an outside group doesn't have to be accountable for its message. George and then Patricia. George and Nick and then Patricia.
So I definitely think that thinking about public financing, small donor financing, is challenging in and of itself. I think that what I guess I'm most intrigued by is the trying to get over the dynamic of independent expenditure money playing the politics of disqualification, that is kind of attacking from behind the scenes a candidate because, you know, unpaid taxes or DUI. And I think that's exacerbated by our single-member winner-take-all district system. I'm intrigued at how public financing would work in an Australian model where you have multi-member districts with like ranked choice voting, because then you couldn't just have an attack ad against one candidate because people could kind of change their preferences and say, okay, well, maybe this isn't my first choice. Maybe I'll vote someone who is similar to that as my first choice instead. So I feel like the dynamics of how the public financing could play with a different set of rules with regards to redistricting could be something to really explore.
That's fascinating. We'll let Rob talk about that if there's time at the end. Nick and then Patricia.
Yeah, just two points. I was going to echo what Michael Malin said. I think the hope of reformers with the new Sarbanes-Bill and other models of small donor public financing is that they'll be robust. So there has to be enough money. If we're on the cheap side, I think in Maine and Arizona, when those systems were designed, we said, let's take careful, tend to the public purse really carefully and make them cheaper. I don't think in this new era you can start at that point. You have to allow people to respond to those attacks. So the Sarbanes-Bill is robust, allows enough public financing to get up to that level. And then if you require, as the law does, that 50% of the matched money come from in-district, you require people to build a huge base, which was not a feature of the original clean elections laws. And our hope, too, is that if a candidate does the work to be known in the community, to raise large numbers of small donors, that defends them against the dumped-in outside attacks. So I just want to echo that hope, and the Sarbanes-Bill actually in the law tries to do that. The second thing on the larger issue of partisanship and legislative leadership, there's a story from Arizona that former minority leader John Laredo tells, who was elected with public financing. He was the minority leader in the House when Jan Napolitano was governor and Republicans dominated the legislature. So he had to put together a budget and work with the governor and work with members of the minority party to do it. And he said he could put together those budgets by putting in sort of sweeteners that would attract Republicans that knew it was good for their district and would defy leadership to do that. And they were always the clean elections candidates in his state because, in this case, actually freeing them from leadership's thumb allowed them to fashion a bipartisan budget. And he would always bring those people on. He said it was the publicly financed candidates that he could always get to do that. So it's just another little bit of information for the thinking about this.
Great. That's fascinating. Patricia.
Hi, Patricia Bauman, Bauman Foundation. Listening to this discussion, I'm thinking about voters or people who are at the grassroots who maybe don't vote because of cynicism. They think really of playing on all of your houses. And Michael, you mentioned motivation and mobilization. And I'm wondering whether small donor matching funds really encourage accountability on the part of people who are running for office and also motivate people to turn out, vote for their candidates, and really participate because they feel they have a stake, even if it's $25. Is there research, is there evidence on that point?
Almost everyone who will give $25 is a voter. So the research, there's a good basis in research to believe, but this is not the same as saying research that's shown, that acting beyond voting in one way gets you to act in other ways. Now, we did see in our research a pretty strong link between willingness to volunteer for a campaign and willingness to give $25. That doesn't tell you which way the causal arrow goes, right? Having mobilizers, that is, volunteers, helps you get more voters. But on the whole, what we're talking about here are the intermediaries. This is not the way you're going to drive voting participation up, I don't believe. And other panels here are going to talk about that. But it is going to drive other forms of political participation up.
I just want to add that I think elections get won in two ways. Money is one, and that's been the subject of this discussion. Voters and casting of the vote is the other way, and I hope we will have a chance to discuss that as the day goes along.
Thanks. Nick Penn.
So I was thinking about my cousin Tommy the other day, who's a lifelong Republican, lives in Naples, Florida, contributes probably $100 to a political campaign. I'm less worried about Tommy's participation. He's just a Republican. He donates to Republicans. Than I am about the fact that an hour ago in Washington, a member of the Finance Committee went into Bistro B, where there were 40 bank lobbyists. He spoke to them for 45 minutes. He walked out of the room, and after he walked out, someone from the lead lobbying firm that set up the lunch handed him a bundle set of checks from the bank lobbyists. It's the highly transactional nature of Washington that gets at me. Now, I certainly believe in the matching fund supervision. I do think we need to turn the gaze of politicians away from the super rich who fund campaigns back to everyone else. But I think that in addition to that, we need to realize that even that might not cut down on the transactional nature of Washington. There still will be an incentive for a member of the Finance Committee to go to Bistro B for 45 minutes and walk away with $100,000 to $150,000 in checks from bank lobbyists. So I do think that part of our conversation about the future has to be about the clampdown on the relationship between lobbying and money. A while ago, we proposed this challenge to Jack Abramoff, Trevor Potter, and Larry Lessig, and they came up with a number of provisions that Trevor's law firm pushed through the filters as well as they could, the legal filters as well as they could. And one of the ideas they came up with was capping lobbyist contributions to politicians at $100. The point is you're not stopping their speech, but you're limiting it, because when someone registers as a lobbyist, they've announced that they have business to grind with the state, and therefore it becomes curious when they're also giving money. So you cut down on the curiosity level. The other idea was to bar members of Congress from raising money from the interests, specifically the executives of corporations and the lobbyists who represent industries that they ostensibly regulate based on their committee assignment. Now, obviously, that gets very complicated with some committee assignments where they have very broad jurisdiction. But with more limited committee assignments, it's kind of an interesting idea. So this is just almost an overture for us to think about that transactional day-in, day-out special interest stuff in Washington, in addition to kind of big systemic change like matching funds.
Great. Thank you. Fred, I think you had your hand.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on independent expenditures. One very strong solution would be to get a new Supreme Court justice. That is beyond our control, but could happen any day. There are things that can be done, but it's a very difficult problem. Nick mentioned one thing. You have to have candidates have sufficient alternative resources so that they can get their message out. Another idea that exists in a couple of states is requiring outside spending groups to disclose their top donors on their ads. That would inform people watching those, seeing those ads immediately if the Koch brothers were the top donors who had given $25 million to the organization to fund it. It is a way of giving more information to people who are being stuck with these ads popping up on their sets of where the money's coming from. And it makes very clear very quickly that these are very rich people who probably have nothing to do with their state. The Price-Van Hollen bill, which is also a multiple matching bill and was based on the New York City system and a proposal by the Brennan Center in Democracy 21, the public financing parts of it, has two provisions that address this to some degree. One provision, we think we could shut down most of these candidate-specific super PACs, which will soon become the most prevalent form of super PACs around. There's the super PACs formed by associates of the candidate. They are arms of the campaigns. They have one purpose, which is to eviscerate the contribution limits. They allow not just unlimited individual contributions, but they allow unlimited corporate contributions to come to the benefit of the candidate. And you can define the characteristics of those organizations in coordination terms that would, in effect, shut them down. And the Price Van Hollen bill has provisions to do that. The second is to start getting some real coordination rules that will at least put some teeth into preventing a coordination between outside spending groups and candidates. Someone pointed out that outside spending groups can be a loose cannon. They can hurt you as well as help you. The coordination rules that exist at the national level are a joke, and as weak as they are, they're not enforced. So if you start to really force independence here, that's another way of trying to address this independent expenditure problem.
Great. Thank you very much, Fred. Before I know Mark Kaplan has his hand up, I want to, before I call on Mark, I want to, is there anybody up in this zone? I haven't had a lot of questions from there. Okay, Mark.
Mark Kaplan from the Piper Fund. This actually goes back to Michael's, something a little removed from that, but if one of the purposes of the small donor matching system or other thing is to be able to get the elected official in really closer touch with his constituents, I believe in LA, maybe Karen would explain if you know more about it, if you can remember, and Kathy Funk from the Common Cause Director in California, I think we'll be here tomorrow, and can specifically address this. They tried to incentivize the matching system. I'm not sure they're matching contributions from outside of LA. And I think they've talked about wanting to put a higher match on in district contributions. So there is ways you can, I think we need to look at that to see if it's really gonna work or the impact it has. The way you can structure the small donor system to really put a premium on having elected officials really focus on their constituents for involvement in funding their campaigns. And it'll be interesting to see what is the impact that is going to be in LA that they're looking at.
There's traditionally been a bit of a racial split on that issue, as African American right. representatives have felt that they don't have the base in their districts. But interestingly, the Sarbanes-Bill has a provision benefiting contributions from within the state, and they have a majority of the Congressional Black Caucus supporting the bill, so maybe we're past that divide. Actually, Jonathan Rausch, you had your hand up before, and I wanted to, since you started all this trouble, I may need to make sure you get in here.
I apologize, I have a 3:00 downstairs, so I'll make this blessedly brief. Just a few small points in passing. One is, this is relation to Michael's point, if the idea of small donor match is to free politicians from to detach them from, say, corporate and big money, that might be successful and might be a good reason to do it. If what you're concerned about from a governance point of view, as I am, is more reattaching politicians to hierarchies and structures that can discipline their behavior, then actually small donor matches might be a step in the wrong direction because it makes them even more independent entrepreneurs than they already are, which is something to think about. If we're talking about incremental things that might actually work here and now, something I floated at one point in print just a little bit and would, you know, I still think it's a good idea, is you could do a deal right now with R's and D's on Capitol Hill in which you increase contribution limits. And in exchange for that, you pass the Disclose Act. And I think that's a win in both directions substantively, and you might actually get it through, though. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. And finally, a maybe less constructive comment, but just I'm going to be the libertarian angel here, or devil maybe, on Mark's shoulder, and just say, for someone who's from a slightly different point of view, the tenor of the conversation here is a bit peculiar, because it sounds a bit like drug prohibition is saying, well, you know, we're so close. We just need one more law, and we're going to make this whole thing work. And from what my point of view, what I see is more like an entire structure just falling apart. And an effort on the part of a lot of people to get it going with one more rule on lobbying, for example, or coordination or this or that. And part of my reaction is, yeah, there's a lot of incremental stuff we're talking about that might help, and I think there's a good case for public financing. But part of my reaction is, hey, guys, wake up. The old paradigm is irredeemably broken. It is time to think in more creative ways about what you can actually do in a Koch brothers world. So, I mean, that's just sort of a challenge, really. It's an outside view. I suppose it's not very constructive. But, you know, for what it's worth, and that may be a good note for me to escape on.
Yeah, get out of here. Get out of here.
Tries to escape. Yeah. Jonathan, yeah, the old world is falling apart. But the status quo world is one where 130,000 individuals in the United States provide the majority of the money for congressional elections. And in fact, the whole idea of trying to bring more people into the system instead of regulating the problems out of the system is a new start. It is a way of expanding the game. I kind of agree with you, but it certainly doesn't lead me to the solutions that you came up with.
Okay. Karen Hubbard-Flynn.
I just wanted to mention one or two things in Connecticut where there's public financing systems, and the goal was to transition from going in a room with a number of lobbyists who could give you the checks that you need and probably two events could cover the cost of a Senate race, to transition to raising small dollar donations, some of which had to come from constituents. One role the caucuses and the party have helped play is to help candidates do some of that small donor fundraising, because that is not something that came easily in Connecticut to candidates that were there. So we've started to see a growth in the caucuses playing that role, teaching candidates how to run under the system and also how to do more small dollar donor fundraising. I mean, we've seen what Obama can do. Congressional races are doing more of that small donor, but when you get to the state level, candidates are not very sophisticated in doing that or doing, you know, online fundraising. The second thing is, although I think that these discussions are compartmentalized by issue, the fact is I don't think public financing is the magic answer. It's one of many. But I think that focusing on small donor engagement can be an empowering countervailing force to the large outside money. Just as we move into discussions about elections and breaking down barriers to engage more people so that they can use their voice and the ballot box and also other systems that we can look at that will allow the voices of more voters into the primaries and other things, I think we have to be looking across many different areas in terms of dealing with these issues.
Great. Thank you, Karen. I want to give Gary Bass the last word. I'm going to give Gary the last word. Sorry, Rob.
Heather, at one point you started by talking about the public is with us in large numbers, although you were also talking, I think it was you that talked about some polling. I'm also mindful of the fact that when there was a very modest proposal, goes to your transparency comment, when the president put out a draft executive order to have contractors and proposed contractors disclose campaign contributions, he got ripped to shreds. There was very little counter response to that. It reminds me of the fact that many of you know now Ambassador Norm Eisen, who then was in the White House working on these issues, who used to complain, where is the base? Where are all the people that are moving on this? And that's why I'm intrigued, Larry, with your democracy initiative. It is an attempt to bring some more of the base. But it seems to me that we can have many policy solutions, Mark, whether it's transparency, whether it's small donors, but until we get a stronger base of people who are going to act on these issues, we're going to be talking to ourselves still in the room. I'm really concerned about that. It's gone on for a lot of years.
Right. Well, we are too, and that's partly the political strategies conversation tomorrow. will hopefully solve that problem. This has been a terrific conversation. I feel like we surfaced some new ideas, got deep, you know, along Michael's line of being smarter about the ideas we have. I just thought this was really fascinating, and I really appreciate everyone's contributions. We now have a break until 4. At 4, will Wendy, can you say a few words about what we're doing at 4? I'll say that it is downstairs on the second floor in the John Sexton Lounge, and Wendy will tell you what will happen then.
We are going to be really privileged and honored to be joined by Bob Bauer and Ben Ginsberg, the co-chairs of the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. They are flying in, I think, on great inconvenience after testifying this morning before the Senate Rules Committee about their work to tell us how they did it, how they were able to overcome their strong partisan divide and actually come up with a bipartisan reform proposal that's really strong and what lessons we can learn from that. So I do hope that everybody makes it. They're coming here to really help us with this conversation and figuring out how to grapple with these dysfunction issues.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. There are more. There's more coffee and snacks outside, and we'll see you downstairs on the second floor in 50 minutes.